Hello and welcome to episode 203, the Washed Up Emo podcast. I am Tom Mullen from washedupemo.com. Thank you for your patience. I had a little break from the podcast after 10 years, and I thought, you know, I started a new job, I took up a bunch of time, and I said, why don't I take a break? So thank you for your support, and as always, reach out anytime via the socials or washedupemo.com. Today, we welcome Cam D'Annunzio from Lazy Kane and Denali. He makes his wares as a composer and music supervisor nowadays, but we spoke about his early days in Virginia Beach, moving to Richmond, and his thoughts on music as he navigated and survived the emo label. Cam's contribution to music, the genre, and further throughout the musical landscape is a reason for you to stick around if you haven't heard of the band or his name. If you have, you are in for a treat. You dive into the Lazy Kane and Denali days, and at the start, as context, I mentioned Cam's bandmate, John, who we worked together when I first moved to New York City, way back, 100 years back in 2000. With that said, as comforting as when a 718 number calls a 917, listening back felt more like a conversation, not an interview. I hope you enjoy. Thank you to all the Patreon supporters out there. I appreciate it. If you want to support, head on over to patreon.com/washedupemo. This is episode 203, Washed Up Emo Podcast with Cam D'Annunzio from Lazy Kane and Denali. John Major to do this for years, and we have a funny history where I, you know, found out where we worked together at the same place, which you worked as well, and I was like, oh my God, you were in Lazy Kane? Like, that's crazy. And so he would never tell anyone when we would meet someone, like work-related. I just expected him to be like, I'm John Major, I work at Cornerstone, and by the way, I was in Lazy Kane, and he never did that. And I was like, John, you're leaving out the best part. And he's like, shut up.
It is part of common courtesy to name your name, your place of employment, and any former bands that you played with.
Yes.
It's just it's like meeting the queen. It's like part of the ritual.
Exactly. So that was always the running joke that I was like, you didn't mention your influential band? And he's like, shut up. So I am happy that you're there. And I think there's a lot of fun parallels, you know, looking back at your history and the bands. And I think there's a lot of stuff to go through from like the New York City scene, the late 90s scene. So I'm stoked that you've always been, you know, this band and the stuff that you've worked on have always been someone that I've been thinking about. So I'm stoked that you're able to do this.
Thank you very much. I was like I said when we sort of talked on the phone earlier, I was like, are you sure you want to talk to me? I was, you know, like I was part of some cool things, but there are definitely people who were probably much more directly responsible for the creation of those cool things. So, I mean, especially when it comes to Denali, but yeah, I appreciate the chance to talk to you about it. It's not, you know, in preparation for it, like I go on these long bike rides and I was just sitting there like for miles on the road, staring at the white line on the right side of the road. Just like, what even happened? Like I have a goldfish memory at this point in my life. It's just like, either that or my RAM is maxed out. And so it took a while to even just sort of cast my mind back to what it was even like back then. So yeah. And also I'm 47. So it just, I think it just comes with age.
What's crazy. Anyway. You mentioned the age 47. I watch YouTube videos of old comedians and sometimes they're on the Johnny Carson show. And I'm not Johnny Carson's fine. I was watching a clip with him and Don Rickles, and this is yesterday, they talked about their age. And so right before they do it, I'm like, man, they're probably in like their 50s or 60s. And they both went, yeah, we just celebrated our 47th birthday.
Whoa.
And it was like a 1972, like Burt Reynolds was on the couch. Like it was ridiculous. Yeah. But I was like, no, is that what 47 looks like?
Man.
So I was disappointed, but also happy that I still feel young. But watching that, I was like, uh-oh.
And now I feel like an underachiever. I feel like I should, you know, there's so much more I should have done with my life at this point.
And he had already been on for 11 years, which was crazy. So,
oh yeah, way behind the ball at this point.
Yeah, we are. So, welcome to the podcast. We are behind the ball on the Washed Up Emo podcast. We are completely pointless. But the other piece that I wanted to start was Richmond, and you know where a lot of this, you know, music came from, where you are now.
So I grew up in Virginia Beach, which is sort of a sprawling suburban resort town on the coast, which has a huge population but no real city center. At least it didn't when I lived there, and I think they've tried to make it happen a couple times, but there's just a lot of little like neighborhood kind of spots. And so the way that Richmond sort of took shape for me was that it just felt like everybody was kind of on the same page in a way. And I came here for school, so it instantly, like, there was this instant community. And so, you know, the only thing that had sort of felt even remotely close to that when I was in Virginia Beach was the magnet school that I went to in high school, which is actually where I met John Major from Lazy Kane. Actually, we met at a one-act play, but he didn't know that. I think I saw him from across the room, and then I recognized him at magnet school. But that was like a sort of a community of artists and things like that. It was the only sort of like collective of like-minded people. Whereas the city as a whole just felt like everybody was off doing their own thing. I don't think I realized that Richmond had a scene, right off the bat, cause I just wasn't looking for it. I started going to shows. I didn't start going to shows period until college, like until I went to VCU. Because there were concerts in Virginia Beach, like at some of the clubs, and there was a hardcore scene in Virginia Beach at that point, but it wasn't something that was really on my radar. I was sort of listening to like either gothy progressive, what was called progressive music back then, which was like Cure and Smiths and all that kind of stuff. Or I was just like hanging out with my girlfriend, or I was in the band, or I was in, you know, I was at band practice. But so the first, I think I was in the dorms in Richmond at VCU, and there was a flyer for a show at this club called the Metro down the street, and it was Shudder to Think and this band called First Five Through and another band called Damn Near Red. And I didn't know who Shudder to Think was. I didn't know anything about. I knew who Fugazi was from high school, but the same kids who listened to Fugazi also listened to the Grateful Dead. So I wasn't aware that there was like a scene around it. I thought it was just like, this is a cool band, this is another popular band, blah blah blah, and people just sort of stitched together their record collection out of, you know, disparate kind of influences. But you know, going to that show, I was totally confused by Shudder to Think. I was like, this is really cool, but I don't know the backstory. And for me, that was like it was exciting to sort of look into it, be like, oh, they're on Discord. And then, oh, these other bands have also sort of like have a similar pedigree. It was going to that show and then other shows after that. I think the next show I saw was Girls Against Boys. A lot of the DC bands would sort of come down to Richmond on their way to Chapel Hill or whatever. And at the time, I didn't know I was seeing these cool bands, but I was definitely impressed. They made an impression. And I was already into music in a big way. And so I sort of, you know, would go to the record store. We had a fantastic record store, still have a fantastic record store called Plan 9. And so go there, and then you just talk to people and kind of learn about it. But then from going to those shows, you sort of see the same people, and then you see them out in the community, which wasn't a thing that happened in Virginia Beach. It was just like, you know, and then you have the backdrop of the city at, you know, in a larger space. And then you learn that it's kind of like DC's little brother in the music sense. And then I think I ended up at an Avail show or a Four Walls Falling show. And then you saw like Richmond bands who had a huge following. And then that was sort of when I got a sense for like the air quote scene of Richmond. And sort of like the parts that we borrowed from DC or the parts that we borrowed from Chapel Hill or like the sort of the merge scene. And you started to see bits of those. Not that there weren't like really amazing, like Gwar is definitely its own thing, but I didn't meet those guys until way later. So yeah, it sort of revealed itself very slowly to me. But I was really sorry. That's the end of that question.
No, you're fine.
That's the answer to that question.
Dude, do not apologize. I'm not gonna interrupt you. You're gonna be able to talk as long as you want. Please. Other podcasts like to be about other people. I just want to have you talk. So,
I appreciate it.
What was was Grip the first band for you?
In Richmond, yeah. I was in cover bands in Virginia Beach, and we would write a couple of original songs. But the issue with VB at the time, unless you're in the hardcore scene, was that the only way to get shows at any of the bars there or any of the venues was to play songs that people knew. And so we did covers. We did like REM and Ocean Blue and The Church and stuff like that. We did cool covers, but it was still cover bands. So the first like all original band that I was in was Grip. And yeah, that came about from just me playing guitar in my room, and this kid named Aaron Edge, who I'm still friends with, came into my dorm, that's in the dorms, and he was like, "Hey man, cool song, like cool guitar, can we borrow your amp?" And I was like, "I'm sorry, who are you again?" And he was like, my band is having practice and our guitar player is having problems with his amp." And it's just like, and I was like, can I come with you? Like, it's just weird to sort of hand my amp off to somebody I don't know. And he's like, yeah, totally. So it was Grip having practice at this house in the FAM, which is a neighborhood next to VCU. And I went, and I had never seen, like, I'd never really seen a hardcore show or seen a hardcore band play at that point, but it smacked of the metal bands that I was into growing up. And I was like, oh, this is cool. And the guys in the band seemed really cool, and all of them I'm still friends with to this day. And at the end of the practice, I was just like, I was noodling around on the guitar again. And I was playing something I think one of them thought was maybe kind of cool. They're like, oh, do you want to like play with us sometime? I was like, sure. And so yeah, that's kind of how it ended up happening. I just went to they gave me a tape of their last live. It was like a soundboard tape of their last show to learn the songs, and that's how I ended up in the band.
I mean, there's really either you play in the shitty punk band or you do the cover bands, and you learn while you're doing it how to play the amp and stuff. So then having that opportunity, like Grip, you weren't like, this wasn't my first rodeo. This was obviously not in that situation, but for having someone to be able to hear that is awesome. And then so this was during college, right?
Yeah. This was like the first 3 months of my freshman year when I was there. And it was sort of weird too. Like I got there and I'd had kind of longish hair, or not longish hair. I had normal length hair. And I decided, like, in a freak rebellious, and I don't even know that I had anything to rebel against, but I was just like, I'm going to shave my head. And so I ended up at this, you know, hanging out with these guys looking like I'd just come from like a shelter show, or hanging out with like, and Aaron was Krishna at the time. And so it was kind of this like, and I'd been in like Young Life in high school, mm-hmm. and like a vaguely religious bent. And then I was doing a little bit of InterVarsity when I got to VCU. Cause I just, my friends in high school, I had trouble making like quality friends, and my girlfriend at the time was part of a Christian family, and they were like super welcoming and warm, and I was like, oh, maybe this is how you meet nice people. And so you know, I was still sort of in that scene a little bit when I got there, and so it may have been a little bit of kind of like Pepe Le Pew, like just like the black cat with the white stripe, yep. that accidentally got painted down. Like I was like, I happen to have a bald head. I happen to be, you know, essentially like textbook straight edge, because I wasn't drinking or doing anything. even though I didn't really know what the word meant at that point. So I just sort of fit in accidentally with these folks, but not everybody in GRIP was straight, and so and it wasn't like a huge thing for them. But yeah, and the other guitar player for GRIP was John Field, who was in this New York hardcore band called Upfront that was really big, like in the early 90s, late 80s scene. And so he kind of showed us the ropes and helped us kind of learn how to be a proper band.
That's amazing. That was one thing about being in the South, meeting some folks in those Christian things. I had no idea. Like watching TV late at night, the public access, there was a guy that would just be like, you know, send in your bills and God will pay them.
right.
Yeah. I was like, this is on TV and people are doing it. Like, these people are going to lose their power or their guests, yeah, you know, like, exactly. Holy shit. And, yeah. And then meeting kids when I brought my records to the radio station and stuff, and they would be like, oh yeah, my parents won't let me have that. I'm like, what? So that was weird. And then there was a lot of those groups that would say, you know, come on a bus trip, there's free pizza. And we were like, nah, I'm good.
Right. Yeah.
Very interesting, like, because there was a whole Christian hardcore scene, Christian metal scene, kind mm-hmm. of like intermixed. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like you had to do like detective work. Even though everybody was great, you just had to kind of know that going in.
Yeah. And I mean, the families of the, it was actually two girlfriends I had in high school were, one was sort of a missionary family and the other mm-hmm. was, I think he was a dentist, but it never felt like predatory, even looking back on it with a clearer head, you know? But it definitely, in terms of sort of assimilation, I felt like the hardcore scene at the time was much had a much stronger hold on the newcomers who came in and was like, these are the rules, this is how it happens, and like, you don't dress like this, you dress like this. And my parents were never like, they were happy that I was just not like doing anything, you know, getting arrested. So right. they didn't really care either way. They were sort of, as far as I know, sort of agnostic. I mean, they sent me and my brother and I to church when we were kids, but they themselves didn't go except for like holidays. I think they just wanted us to be good people. And there were also some neighbors who like would take us. And so we just did that. But,
I just think they wanted an hour alone. That's pretty much what it was.
Exactly. I think you've hit it perfectly. That's exactly it. It's just like, get these kids out of here, please.
We want to clean the basement. We haven't been able to. Sunday morning it is.
Yeah. Well, and I grew up on like a horse farm kind of thing with just like endless grass to cut and chores to do. And so I think they were just, you know, that might have just helped them get like a little bit further ahead of whatever it was they were trying to do. But yeah, it was cool. But yeah, I mean... It was very clear early on that Richmond had like a strong sense of community. I didn't know what it meant to the outside world at that point in freshman year of college.
So then, yeah. So with GRIP, you were playing shows. Was it like weekend stuff? Like what else was kind of happening around that time that, was it like, man, I really like this. Like, this is fun doing my own stuff, or you're meeting a bunch of people like that. That must have been, you know, obviously, you know, probably excitement or other thoughts or God, I want to do something else. What was thinking then?
We were pretty much weekend warriors, in town shows during the week, but most of us were in school. And so we had to be around for class. You know, nobody was really like, fuck this, I'm just doing the band kind of thing. We were all still pretty like adherent to our, you know, responsibilities, or at least conscious of the commitment we had made to higher learning. So yeah, we were around for the most part, but we would do, you know, DC shows on the weekend and sometimes Jersey or New York shows. That became pretty frequent. And yeah, it was super cool. I mean, the very first time I played guitar with a group of people was like, I was like 14 years old and we were playing Iron Maiden songs and U2 songs. It was just like, those were the things that that the two groups of people in the room liked. But you know, even playing other people's music in synchronicity was just this magical thing that sort of flipped the switch for me. But then to answer your question, playing with you know, a group of and playing all our own stuff as opposed to, you know, a night full of covers and then like, oh, we wrote this next one ourselves, like, which is, you know, just sort of like trying to squeeze something in and hoping everybody doesn't leave during those like 3.5 minutes was really cool. It's like, holy shit, people are coming out to see us, like, for our songs. And regardless of what you think of hardcore or any genre of music, I think there's just like a, it's just a rush to be, you know, to have people want to pay money or just to want to come, like, drop whatever else they're doing and come and see your band play or see, be, you know, tolerate you while they wait for the band that they actually want to see play.
Totally.
But it was cool. But yeah, it was mostly Weekend Warrior stuff. They didn't go on tour until after I left the band. And that was, I actually, I have a document because I'm sort of OCD about this stuff. Like, I was in the band from, like, November of 92 until, or I was playing shows with them November of 92 until about a year later. And I didn't, I left the band only because I wanted to do, I like, hardcore was cool, but I was listening to a lot of other stuff besides. I was one of those kids who didn't really listen to hardcore. I just liked playing the songs. There was other stuff that I wanted to try and do. And I think I sort of naively thought, like, oh, well, I was in this band because, you know, on flyers, obviously, you always see like X members of blah, 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 blah. And, mm-hmm. you know, I was like, well, they'll see X grip or whatever and they'll come see us play. And I was like, nope, no translation whatsoever. I think, you know, a couple of people may have given us a chance, but I was just the guitar player in a band of five people. And Ken, our singer, was the outsized personality of the band. So they might have been like, oh, that's nice, but not enough to give up whatever they were doing to come and see us play. So it was kind of a long slog. Lazy Cane formed with just myself and two friends from the beach. And we played in, you know, just a couple shows and not too many people came. But I think we believed in it enough to try and keep going. But yeah, so that was... Grip was great, and all those people are fantastic. I see Ken and Rich around, and Aaron is actually, I think he was in the Pacific Northwest. It looks like he's moving to London now, but yeah. So and John, it lives in the same neighborhood as me, so it's all good. Richmond still has a sort of a pull to people to a certain degree.
I love that. So Lazy Cane, I joked earlier that, you know, I think they should be mentioned more. you guys did a lot of stuff, and it was an interesting time that I want to get into. But yeah, meeting Dan, meeting John, and starting to play. What was happening in your ears? What was happening when you were together? That felt right.
I've always sort of been a product of my surroundings, musically for sure. And I think I was hearing so many new things, in and around Richmond, just from the people who lived in the dorms with me in the freshman year. And then, the friends I made from there and their record collections. I mean, it was everything from, like, the Fugazi and the Discord thing to Bad Brains to I don't even know, like Enigma. You know, there was like I listened to everything, and so I think I thought there was something. Obviously, like, starting a band for most people is an act of like of artistic expression, and I don't know that I think there was part of that for me, but there was also part of like, I want to show people what I can do. Now that I was playing original music. And so I think it was just an amalgamation of all these new influences that were coming in. Dan and John and I, I started the band with a couple of other people, and then Dan lived across the street from me. Once I'd moved out of the dorms and into the neighborhoods, Dan lived across the street from me, and I could hear him playing drums in his apartment. I was like, oh my God, that guy's awesome. And I asked him, and our other drummer lived in Virginia Beach, and it was tricky to set up practices and stuff like that. And then John, I asked... to be in the band at one point. He was in a band called Behavior Control that was really good. And I asked him to be in the band at one point. I don't think he remembers this because I feel like I've brought it up with him before. And he said no because he was still busy with Behavior Control or he just wasn't into it. And then either he came back and said something later or I went back to him again. I can't remember. And said like, hey, are you sure it'd be really cool to have, not just a second guitar player, but him specifically as another guitar player in the band, because our styles are very different. And I thought they complemented each other. But I think we were just sort of fusing all of our influences at that point. And that's just kind of how it started out. It was, there was no master plan. I didn't have like a pile of songs. It was just, the way that I write songs or the way that I wrote songs, I guess I still do, was sort of in textures and pieces and things like that. And they all sort of borrowed sometimes very heavily from what I'd listened to recently or what I'd been listening to. And I think we just all were kind of listening to the same stuff to a certain degree with, within the sort of indie music scene.
Had you heard the word emo yet?
No. It's funny because I in preparation for this interview, I was like, there's going to come a point where Tom's going to say, when did you hear the word emo? And I was trying to place it. And I don't remember. I do remember hearing, if we're going by like the touchstone, the traditional touchstones, or the flagship bands. Like I remember hearing Sunny Day for the first time on like the late night Sunday indie hour of my local radio station in Virginia Beach when I was home for the summer. And I was like, oh my God, this is great. I love this song. And then went out and bought it. I didn't know that was, I had no connection to Rites of Spring at the time. I sort of went from 92 forward. I didn't really go back and do homework much on what had come before until way later. So I wasn't conscious of first wave. And so I was just like, Sunny Day's cool. And to me, all of that stuff sounded like either, I guess we called it melodic hardcore or post-rock or post-hardcore, mm-hmm. Kind of thing. And I was listening to Williams' interview with you, not that I know him well enough to go by a first name, but I was listening to William Goldsmith's interview and like he was talking about how he felt like they were a hardcore band that was just trying to like flesh out ideas that they had, and that's just what they sounded like doing that. And mm-hmm. I thought that was really genuine, really cool. I don't remember when I heard it, and I never really thought of Lazy Kane as an emo band. I know we ended up on the compilation, the Emo Diaries compilation.
You were on the first one.
I know. It's really weird. I don't know how that happened.
You don't know how that happened?
Well, no. I mean, I remember being asked, obviously, but I just don't... I mean, we played with a lot of bands that were... Like, we had played with Mineral at one point, and we may have played with Jimmy Eat World at that point. It's weird because, in preparation for this, I went back and listened to a lot of the Lazy Kane stuff, and I don't think of us as an emo band. I definitely think of us as like a post-hardcore band or a post-rock band. So
that's the funny part about this time period, which if you're ready to like sort of dive in a little bit, I think people are used to this. Like that era was like, it's not like you're... band came out, you're playing shows, and then you've got Instagram and Twitter to scroll and, stuff to check. Like, it kind of, these pockets of things would happen, and you'd play with a band somewhere, and then that would sort of permeate wherever you went, or mm-hmm. these things would happen. And I feel like, that Emo Diaries thing, like, again, I'm from your school of, like, I just thought it was another thing of hardcore. Like, it was a hardcore band that, like, just played a little bit differently. And I liked both. I was cool with, the hardcore bands, and I liked this too. I'm happy mm-hmm. if they were at the same show. And I think
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But that, listening back to Stupid Maybe Still on the first chapter of the Emo Diaries, which You know, it feels angular, it's heavy, but it's like a hardcore band. I mean, it's almost Helmet.
Yeah. Well, they were a big influence on me, and I think just rhythmically they were an influence on the band to a certain degree. I don't know that. I don't know if it was just like the stuff that I was writing that they then translated for their parts, but I loved the sort of rolling rhythms that, you know, at things that sort of fell over the next bar and the spaces and everything like that. I'm pretty sure that was probably me trying to write a Helmet riff.
Well, that is my second favorite band of all time, so I approve that.
Right on.
So were labels reaching out? Like, when did, you know, was it from the Emo Diaries? Did people reach out? Like, when did, because again, this isn't instant. I want people to remember that. Like,
right.
Literally, you don't get a DM. Like, okay?
This is not instant. No.
How did this evolve to kind of like, I mean, there's other references we'll tell later, but how did those start to sort of permeate?
We were literally the band that opened for all the cool bands that came through town.
And so awesome.
I think that's how word got around. And it wasn't because we had a huge draw. I think we had enough of a draw that we wouldn't ask for the moon in terms of a guarantee. And so every time like Shades Apart or Sensefield or, you know, one of those bands would come through, we didn't always get asked, but we got asked a lot. And I think that, you know, the more that happened, the more, you know, people talked to their friends or the people who ran the labels that they were on. But it was a fucking slog. Like, we were around for 6 years, and I think, you know, we never were able to live off of that band. We didn't sell a lot of records. We didn't get hooked up with, you know, hooked into the, like, the Big Wheel Doghouse circuit until the very end. And by that point, I think we were pretty fried. And I think John and Webb and Dan really wanted to do John's J-Rolls project. And so it was just like, you know, it wasn't, you know, the tour we did with Piebald was at the very end. And that was Rama from Big Wheel being like, hey, you should take these guys out. And I think we were good enough where people thought like, okay, cool, this is not going to be embarrassing. Mm-hmm. But it was just, it was a lot of empty opening slots. And, you know, it's funny, I've heard other people talk about, I listened to the Thomas Barnett interview just because he's such a fantastic dude. He was talking about the list that used to go around, and we had the list too. I would remember like Dan and I with a dialer. I don't know if you remember these dialers.
Yes. That is probably the third most referenced thing from this era. Oh yeah, totally. Like, and I learned it from Braid, Eric Richter from Christy Front Drive. Everyone's got someone they learned it from. Or learned it from whatever the English grammar
exactly.
is.
Exactly. I don't want to rat anybody out, but yes, we got one as well. And we would sit, I remember specifically like in the back stairwell of one of the buildings at VCU where there was a payphone, and we had Dan had a legal pad, and I had a 3-ring binder with like the Book Your Own Fucking Life con numbers and this other just like dot matrix printout of just numbers with no names on them, with just cities next to them. And, you know, we would just like, you do the dialer, you call people, and every once in a while the operator comes on and yells at you for not using real money. But you just, you know, you keep going. But that was it. I mean, the way that we got around or got anywhere was just by like just saying yes to every show that we got asked to play. And eventually the band's started to take us out with them. So yeah,
that's so cool. I saw you then toward the tail, and I saw you when you guys were fucking over it. So I saw the Jimmy World at the drive-in tour.
Oh well, that was actually right before. I don't know that we were necessarily over it at that point. It was, but I think it was after all of that when we still weren't really selling records, and we can talk about that later. You know, that we were just like, God, seriously, like, you know, what is the deal? Why are we not connecting? So, I don't know how we ended up on that show.
I think you guys played like two or three. If I'm looking at the setlist.fm, or I was looking, I feel like you guys hit like two or three of those, but the routing was nuts.
Yeah, it was weird. We only did that one show with the two of them. Oh. I think the other one, I can actually look back at my nerdy little document here.
Please do.
But I have to, it may take a second, but that was one of those things where I think we had played somewhere in North Carolina and someone had seen us and who was a promoter, and then the next show, or we had played that venue and made enough of an impression on that, you know, whoever the promoter was, that the next, you know, the band came through, or we got a hookup through somebody else. It was all word of mouth. I mean, it was always word of mouth. Like the only, you know, we got to play certain shows because a friend spoke up for us, or, you know, somebody vouched for us. Like, I think a lot of bands early days like had that connection, but that was essentially most of our career up until until we sort of linked into to Rama's whole network of people. But yeah, it was hard. I was going to say, I mean, I think the, yeah, anyway, that was what I was going to say.
What about, like, I've looked at some No Knife footage that I got from one of their tours, and you guys played a bunch of shows as well on that, mm-hmm. and there's some hilarious moments from the guys, and what about that time period and being in those years, and it could have been toward the tail end, you guys have been doing it for a minute, but what was the, like, did it feel like, it felt like there was a camaraderie of, wow, like those guys did this, or, hey, that's really cool. And again, the slowness of it, like it's not this right. instant DM, you know, you emailing me or DMing me and saying this happened. It like, it was almost like there was this pause, but it still felt like a big deal. What was that? What, as you're still in it, you're still being on the road, you're getting those favors done. Like, did it feel like, wow, something's happening? Like our friends are getting this or we're getting that. It was, again, the momentum shifted later, but in that moment, it seemed like there was this camaraderie.
Yeah. No, there was. I mean, that tour specifically, like a lot of the times, like we did that, those 3 weeks with Jimmy Eat World and No Knife, and that I think came out of us opening for Jimmy Eat World previously, whether it was that show with At the Drive-In or somewhere else, or the show, you know, a couple days later in Richmond, mm-hmm. that very much felt like the prime of Lazy Kane, and I think just the whatever the vibe of the No Knife guys and the Jimmy Eat World guys and us, it just worked. I tell everybody, like, it felt like Christmas every day. It was like, that was our first proper tour. We had gone out on our own before, but that was our first proper like opening tour. And I think our first show was in the like Florida maybe, and we walked, it was in Jacksonville, and Jacksonville, which I could kind of take or leave, no shade, we walked in and, like, you know, the band, like Jimmy World was warming up and the No Knife guys were loading in, we were meeting everybody, and there was a line of kids outside waiting to get in. We're like, oh my god, this is what it's like, this is what real like and that, and like as the tour went on, like we got more comfortable with each other, obviously. There were, you know, with friends bands that were also sort of, you know, we didn't have you know, I'm trying to think of, like, again, my goldfish memory is failing me here, of who else, like, was sort of coming up around that time in Richmond. I mean, Strike Anywhere may have already started at that point. Obviously, they were, like, building on a hella strong foundation from Inquisition. Guar was always going. Avail was always going. I don't know if Avail had broken up at that point, actually. You know, and I wouldn't put us in the same league as those bands in terms of success, but it did. I mean, it felt like a good time. We like I said, we got along with everybody, and it just sort of instantly fell in, and we ended up doing a lot of shows with No Knife after that. In either Lazy Kane and Denali played a couple shows with them, It felt like things were about to happen for sure. Whatever happen means, it was cool. It was definitely cool.
Can we talk about some songs? Cause I want to mention, one, sure. No, sorry. I didn't mean like you need to stop talking. I was more of just like, God, I always forget to do this, but like the angularness of it, that was something that like really connected to me early on. Like I had to sort of like sit in it for a minute. And kind of like No yeah. Knife, kind of like where like the first time you listen through, you're like, okay. And then that second time, it wasn't like hit you over the head on that first time. Oh my God. And that's no slight. I actually want that. That's what I didn't like about hardcore. Hardcore was like, don't tell me, here comes the breakdown. You know, like, I mean, you could literally just, you know, paint by numbers. And I, sometimes you need that. Sometimes your brain just give it to me straight.
Yeah, yeah.
But talk about a song, specifically the one I liked or worth referencing is the Subway song.
So it's funny because I think Lazy Came is a very democratic band in that it may have been John or I that brought like a riff in to start things, but Dan and Webb both had very strong opinions, not in a bad way, but they were definitely, it was very much a collaborative thing. And I think a lot of the reason that we went unexpected places was just because we had, you know, an idea that somebody else had, you know, one person would start the song and the other person's idea didn't necessarily, like, you know, we would go from minor sections to major sections and like 5/4 sections to 4/4 sections or whatever. And I think it was the mashup of those ideas. But then it was also, I think, us trying to be different, maybe sometime just for different sake, but then other times for, you know, what we felt like the song called for. But we were all sort of like, you know, went to music school and, you know, or studied music at some point. And I think we enjoyed kind of trying to bring a little bit of that knowledge, or skill into the practice space. And I think, you know, listening back on it now, like some of it comes across as like coulda more than shoulda in a way, you know, like I listen back and I'm like, really? We did that after that other section. With Subway Song, I'm trying to remember the genesis of that track. I'm pretty sure that I wrote the initial riff. I remember the song. I do remember the song. And that's really only just because I went back and listened to the stuff over the last month, because I'd really, like I said, Goldfish, and I just hadn't listened to a lot of that in a long time. But you know, it was a riff that I had and a pattern that Dan came up with, and then Webb's part and John finding something really cool and kind of out to play over top of it, which was something he was really good at, and stuff that I never would have thought of. And I think a lot of times at first blush was like, that's too weird. And then, you know, but I had no role to like overrule him. And he might remember these processes different. He might have said that, like, no, you told me I couldn't play that. It was that kind of building thing. It was usually a riff, a pattern, a bass line, and then John laying something really cool over top of it. But that song, I remember specifically the lyrics were written in New York. I remember being at a coffee shop or a restaurant with my girlfriend at the time. And while we were visiting, I wasn't living there. And so it was one of those places in like near Soho or the East Village where the floor rumbles every time the train goes by underneath. And so it literally was very seesay in that way. We definitely liked space between notes. I think that's, you know, maybe there's a little bit of Helmet influence in there for that. And I think that's where that song sort of came from. I do like that song a lot. Like of the ones that I listen back and I think like, oh, I would have changed this, would have changed that. I think that's a song that I really had few notes for.
Any other songs that when you were listening back stuck out to you that you were like, oh man, I forgot about that, or that was really cool.
I forgot about all of them. The course correction that I have in my head now for a lot of these songs would just have been to like musically, I think a lot of them are super cool. And I think we did a lot of, like, we were very inventive with rhythms and with chord structure. I think lyrically, like, I'm going to be my own toughest critic here, but I just wish that I had tried to connect with people more or just be less obtuse. Because, you know, when I talk about how, like, even after doing these cool tours, like stints with this band, that band, the other band, we still weren't really seeing any difference in terms of, like, record sales or, you know, being like that going out on our own and having sellout shows. I think the music was there, and the music had a cool thing going on. And I think, especially after the EP came out, I think the next album that we would have made would have been really cool. I think it would have benefited for us to work with a producer to just sort of self-edit a little bit. But the lyrics were just so... It was just like a snapshot of this, a snippet of that, snapshot of this, snippet of that. And they didn't form a cohesive picture. They may have from sort of like a pointillistic kind of view. It's just like cool thing here, cool thing here, cool thing here, cool thing here. But it didn't really connect in the way. And you know, if we're putting this in the context of emo or emotional music, like there were no, I didn't think there were that many sockets for people to plug into and think like, oh, I relate to this, or this is a feeling that I had, or this is a situation that I went through. And I think that lack of connection with people, with listeners, is kind of what kept people at arm's length. We were a critic's fave, and we were often a band's fave for the technical side. And when we were like tour tight, it was I think people, like, we felt like we played really well and people were impressed by that. But lyrically, like from an emotional connection, we just didn't have that. So that there was no glue there. And so I think when I listen back, to answer your question, that's the thing that I would think like that I think like, oh man, you really missed an opportunity to just to open up, and maybe find some connective tissue to the people listening.
I love that. Last question around Lazy Kane, and I want to move on because a bunch of stuff that I think is fun because we have a same New York overlap, and this time period, and, you know, having it, have people mentioned Lazy Kane? Have you had other, back and forth with people that have referenced it? Again, the reason I'm asking that is that sometimes these things bubble up later in years, or people find it, and especially with streaming and YouTube and all these other places to find stuff, people do end up stumbling upon it. Have you had moments like that where in the last, you know, years since around it?
You can say no. Not really. It's funny because I was looking for Lazy Kane on Spotify to see if it ever got uploaded, and the only thing up there is the EP, which is not a bad representation, but the album's not up there, and there are definitely parts of the album that I like more, and I think if nothing else, it's cohesive around the idea of an angry 20-something year old just yelling about stuff. No, I you know, there are occasionally I'll bump into folks in town and be like, oh yeah, hey, you know, I used to go to your shows or whatever, but not so much. People aren't really, I think the most frequent communication I have is from one of our early bass players who wants to share our early demo tapes with his son, which I'm being like, I've been really remiss in going through my cavernous storage space and finding those tapes for him. But yeah, it's not really a thing at this point, unfortunately.
That's fine. Well, welcome to the podcast. That's a pretty normal. It's usually just me, so that's fine.
I appreciate that you appreciate it.
So I do think, and it's the one that's not up is the Big Wheel. So
yeah,
because I think the Doghouse one is up. So we'll have to harass Rama, I will harass you offline about the demos to get those up. So I will work on that for everybody.
Cool.
And then after this was done, you graduated school, you moved out to New York, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was 99. No.
I was still in Richmond. So after Lazy Kane broke up, I was in another band for a short period of time for about a year, and then Denali started. And so all of Denali took place before I moved to New York, which was in 2005. Yep.
I, for some reason, had thought we overlapped at Cornerstone.
I don't know. I was never at, I was never in the office at Cornerstone. I was always remote.
Probably why. Because
you may have been there.
I was probably there because I remember my boss at the time, John Staub, was like, this is, you know, he always mentioned Cam. And I knew it was you. And but you're right, you were never in the office. There we go. See, there's my goldfish.
There you go. There you go.
I had no fucking idea. but that was my first job in the in New York City.
Same. That was my first New York job, not in New York City.
I think we got. I think if we got paid
What years were you there?
September. Well, actually, July or June 2000 for a few months, and then I went back in 2003. But I was sort of. I still stayed in touch with everybody that worked there, so I would always be at the parties. I would always be at the Fader Forts or whatever things would happen. So. So yeah, I kind of stayed in touch with most people that were there. So yeah, I had two stints there.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. No, John was super. Well, he was Lazy Kane's unofficial manager, or I should say official manager. He was the only one who showed any interest in managing us. So he is as much of a manager as anyone could have been. But mostly, I mean, because we weren't really. Fielding tons of requests, we did. We would get the random. We get an email or a letter from someone at some major label who had seen a review in CMJ, or there was a guy from Arista who used to come out and see us, but it never really progressed beyond those sort of like sniffing arounds of things. But John helped us get shows. He saw us at a CMJ showcase. That's how we met. I think he had come to see another band. I feel like this sad comedian who's just making these like at least these like just drab references to our like failed success. But John, I think, had come to see another band who he either missed or had canceled, and he saw us instead. I was like, oh, you guys are pretty cool. Do you want help? Like, you know, just being a band. And so he helped. He would get us really cool shows. I mean, and we got to play some really. Like, we got to play with Bark Market at CB's, and we got to play with Bad Religion at Coney Island High. Like, it was, he definitely put us in the right places. His brother helped us record demos for the pre-production for 5 days, 80 hours. So yeah, he was great. And then when I did move to New York in 2005, he helped, he and a couple of other folks at Cornerstone sort of put the word out, or we're just sort of listening out for opportunities, and I got the interview at RCA from one of those folks. So yeah,
Cornerstone.
I have a very very fond memories and a soft spot for the Cornerstone crew.
So with Denali, and I think to me when I heard about this, I was like, oh shit, supergroup, because we got Keeley. Engine Down, we got Fuller from Sleepy Time. I was like, hello, let's go. How did you guys get together?
So we had met, Webb is from, the bass player from Lazy Kane is from Lynchburg, which is where Keeley Marr and Jonathan grew up in sort of south central western Virginia. I think it's definitely western. Mara had come to town at some point, and he was driving her around or showing her the city, or she was driving him around. I forget the order. And I met her then, and then just for a minute, and then made a connection. Sorry, I'm giving way too much backstory. I met her. I ran into her after Lazy Kane had broken up, and after I was playing with this other band, River City High, for a minute.
I love that band, by the way.
Oh, right on! It was super fun. It was totally polar opposite of Lazy Kane. And
what was the lead singer's name again?
James.
James.
James Menifee.
Record cover of the full length or whatever that one that was mostly out. That was a fucking great cover. Great songs. Like, I just think like a few years before they should have come out.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's crazy. They were, you know, his previous band had a pretty good following in Richmond. And Mark was in Inquisition with Thomas. And so there was, like, they had a pretty good, they had a great following right out of the gate. So it was fun to actually just step into a band that was already active and have people at your shows. And, like, you know, and I think my first show with them was with, let me look it up. It was with Saves the Day and Newfound Glory and in New Jersey. Like, so it was just absolutely fucking bonkers. Like 700, 800 kids. Like,
wow.
I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. At like an Elks Lodge. And it was like, oh God, this is what I've been working to, this is what I'm trying to like achieve for so long. And it was really fun, but it wasn't as fun as it was to play with them. It wasn't artistically what I wanted to be doing. And, you know, just in the way that you run into people in a small town, I ran into Tamara one day and she was talking about how she had a bunch of songs. And she was putting together a thing with her brother Keely and with Jonathan, and I just sort of like invited myself in a way, because it just sounded like, I was like, oh, this sounds really cool. I was like, do you need another guitar player by chance? And she was like, yes, because I don't want to be the only guitar player. And so I went to a practice and it was just really cool. I only knew Jonathan and Keely sort of like not distantly, but not super well at that point. Our bands hadn't crossed paths. I don't know that Lazy Kane ever played with Sleepy Time. But they had, there was a very specific sort of, not specific scene, but they were definitely more of the punk scene. Like 400 Years and all those bands and Men's Recovery Project. And whereas we were in the sort of, you know, like melodic post-hardcore scene and the sort of like emo scene. And not that people don't consider those bands to be that way, but we just sort of got to work fleshing out these songs of Mara's, and you could just tell from the four tracks that she made, like there was just something really amazing and magical to her music, and it aligned so much, you know, sort of selfishly with like what I had always wanted to do. I guess I sort of mentioned it briefly in the past, but I grew up like my first like aha moment with music was listening to super early Cure stuff. And I listened to a lot of that, like the UK, like Smiths and Stone Roses and Depeche Mode and New Order and all that kind of thing. And there was a way to sort of incorporate all of that in a way, like with what Mara was doing. And when the four of us got in a room together, it was just really cool. It was really easy. There was no struggle to come up with great ideas. It was always sort of like choosing the best of three ideas. And I don't know, that it for me at least, it felt like it was like, I was like, oh my God, this is the band I've always wanted to do.
Wow.
I left River City High, James was a little bummed because he was rightfully so, because he very much so had been building the momentum of the band, but he understood, and the Bob, the guy who replaced me, was a much better guitar player than I was anyway, and so I think they were onto much better things, so we just sort of started playing. I remember we just sort of spent the summer in Jonathan's apartment, working out songs. Thank you, Jen, for letting us practice at Jen is Jonathan's wife. And it was really sort of hushed, and you know, just Mara was singing through the same amp that one of us was playing through. It was very sort of organic. And I remember sort of playing some of those practice tapes for our friends, and they had like kind of the same reaction. They're like, oh man, there's really something cool going on here. And so we just kept working up the songs, and we I forget what happened. I think Jason Engine Down had some shows in later that year that they were supposed to play in DC in Chapel Hill, and Jason from Engine Down got appendicitis like at the last minute, and they had to cancel. And so it was just like 2 days beforehand, I was like, oh, hey, do you guys want to come and play these shows that Engine Down was going to play? And so all of a sudden it was like, all right, we're a real band now, you know, quote unquote. And our first show was in Baltimore with The Rapture. And it was just really cool. Like, I don't know, there was nothing stressful about it. And then we played with other cool bands too. I feel like these interviews are always just sort of really, they feel like name drop sessions, but it's like, this is how it happened. But I just say that because we were just like immediately like dropped in the deep end of like, holy shit, here's a band that you sort of have to hang with. Not that it's a competition, but like, you know, like, I hope you've got your shit together because these, you know, there's going to be kids there. And then, yeah, it sort of built from there, and people in Richmond, like, who started paying attention. And then again, it's sort of, you know, you play with people who tell other people and people who tell other people. And we played Philly. I forget how we got hooked up with Jade Tree, and I'm sort of getting ahead of myself, but yeah, it was a very sort of organic thing.
I love that. No, like, please do not apologize for name dropping. Please do not apologize for moving ahead. I've already messed up timing because I had thought two other things that were incorrect, and so I fucked up. So don't worry. It is a
fuck.
We are all good. I thought the funny thing about this timing is you were in Lazy Kane in these late 90s and sort of before the emo boom. This kind of new thing was happening. Being at a label then and watching A&R guys go, oh, wait, so no one wants Limp Bizkit bands anymore? I'm serious. You know, and, you know, they were starting to ask me what I was listening to, and I was like, this is fucked up. I'm 21.
That's awesome.
And you don't know what's happening? Like, wow, I guess I don't understand the music biz. And so I think the timing was so cool. And I think looking back at some of your tour dates and bands and sort of things happening, did you feel like there was this other thing happening? And you can say no, like you've done earlier. Like, I just felt like you kind of dropped in at a really good time.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're definitely like, we started out right alongside the whole New York thing. So,
right.
Like you said, yeah, Interpol, Strokes, fucking TV on the Radio, and like all those bands,
MGMT.
Not that we were connected to that scene, but it just felt like a good time for the East Coast, in general. You know, if we could sort of like coattail that, but so yeah, it was cool. I mean, we played with a lot of the bands that were in and around that, and we did shows with French Kicks, and we did shows with the Stills, and you know, it was just a really, there was so much cool stuff. Like Granddaddy was just starting to get going, and like there were so many good records coming out. And I think, I don't know, maybe Tim and Darren sort of saw that, and or they just got tired of hardcore. I mean, I think, you know, by the time we got to J Tree, they had already put out UFOne, they'd put out Touring Machine, they'd put out, you know, Jets to Brazil, they had put out, like, they were definitely moving away from just, I mean, Kid Dynamite was still very much a thing, and, you know, they definitely still had, and Strike Anywhere, obviously, who I basically, like, I would credit with getting us signed, because they sort of, like, Tim was aware of us, but I think Matt Smith and the folks from Strike Anywhere really kind of put it in their ear, like, hey, there's this band you should check out. It was like what grunge, I guess, felt like in the early 90s. Like the New York and Montreal thing that was happening in the early 2000s was just like was amazing, and it was just great to be kind of on the road at the same time as those bands, and we did play with a lot of them too, but it was just, you know, I cannot not mention Sparkle Horse.
Yes, but great reference.
Well, we worked with Mark on the first record, and you know, and it was just like And he was doing, like, Mark is obviously, like, I only got to know him for a very short time, and I miss that friendship before he passed on. But, you know, there were just so many good records coming out. And I think, yeah, I think Daytree must have just felt like, I really don't want to speak for Tim or Darren, but I think you should definitely have them on if they will consent, if you haven't already had them on. But it'd be interesting to see what writing they thought was on the wall. I mean, one line drawing, owls, like all that stuff was very different for them. And yeah, it was great to A, just be on a label that was fair, like, you know, growing up idolizing Merge and Discord, like quote unquote the right way to put out records and the right relationships to have with your bands, that felt magical. But also just to, you know, that Daytree's fans didn't immediately just sort of turn their backs, or, you know, I think they knew that there were sort of a change of things going on, and yeah, I think people gave us the benefit of the doubt, and I'm very thankful for that.
What about some of the, like, that self-titled record, and, you know, those songs and press and all those things, like you said earlier, like, you know, you playing River City High in Jersey and all those kids showing up in the line, or those last tours with Jimmy and having people line up, like, now you kind of had other people you know, playing these shows, and it was different people, different, mm-hmm. Maybe some overlap. I was in there, and others obviously, but there was, like, it was almost like you'd opened up a different door. Do you remember, you know, any memories from, like, those first records and doing that stuff and being like, oh shit, like, people are covering this. People are paying attention.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely a shift from Lazy Kane, where, you know, we might get like a listing, whereas with Denali we would get write-ups, or there would be a picture, and that was sort of an indication to me that it meant something more to the people who were hearing it. I think that in terms of you know, the kids who were giving us their first dollars, I think a lot of those were, like, Engine Down was well established at that point. They had done, like, tons of touring, and they were well known within that scene. So I think a lot of our first fans were Engine Down fans, and thankfully they stuck around. I think there were a lot of I don't know. I'm sort of losing the plot here. it definitely did feel like, yeah, it garnered more media attention, and yeah. And I remember getting written up in bigger papers, and like finally being able to send them to my parents and saying, right, like, look, you know, but yeah.
Did it feel like a full-time thing?
It felt like it could be a full-time thing. It felt like we were working towards that. And we were, you know, we eventually got to the point where we were mostly able to cover our expenses. But yeah, it felt like, you know, it did feel like it could get there, but we had signed for a few records with Daytree, so we weren't going anywhere at the moment. And not that they weren't treating us well, but I think we had we knew that it was going to be sort of a journey. But make no mistake, like, some of our first shows were to nobody. There was a show in Pennsylvania where we played a show in Pennsylvania, and then some kid in Ohio was like, hey, you should come here, play in my house. And he hadn't, like, it turned out that it was his parents' house, and he hadn't flyered the show, and he also didn't have a key to his parents' house. And so it was just this weird, like he had to break into his house, and we ended up driving a long way not to play, and then just turning around and coming back. But so there were a couple sort of missteps at the beginning, but yeah, it felt like it had momentum.
Any other songs that, or sorry, not any other, any songs stick out for you that you, when you were listening back or thinking about Denali, that, that you were fond of?
I, I like them all. It sounds weird to say. From the first record, I think, you know, Gunner was always like, I think Gunner was one of the first songs that we wrote. And that, you know, and so I think there's always a soft spot for that track. And it was definitely like a fan favorite. It was kind of like one of our encore songs. I really liked Normal Days. Like, it just this sort of weird, like, it felt like it was kind of angular. I think maybe that's one reason I gravitated towards that. But they all had really cool elements to them that I felt like, oh yeah, this was, I'm really like glad we chose this, or we chose that. But yeah, I know that sounds like such a cop out. Be like, they're all my favorite children. We have such a small catalog. It's easy to go like, yeah, we when it was written in such a condensed period of time, it's not like I can say like, well, our early period, like, you know.
I forgot about too was the DVD that Lovett put
right
out.
Right. Yeah. So we had a friend who did production work, film production work, and he would come and film our shows. And we just had all this footage laying around after the last, after that first record, or after we broke up, and from, you know, various shows. And so he put it together. And Brian was always super supportive of the band, Brian Lowett, and so he was gracious enough to put it out for us. I think it's got some home movies on it too, which were cool. Just like things that we put together on tour. But I always forget about the DVD too.
it's not available anywhere. I think someone ripped it and threw it on YouTube, but I think it might be just clips of it. But has there been any talk of just like having it out there officially somewhere?
I don't think so. We sort of, the band doesn't, like, we are all still familiar. Obviously, Keely and Mara are super familiar. And Jonathan and I work in the same sort of career space. But other than, just the occasional, like, oh, hey, the first record turned 20 today. Like, you know, that's about it. We all had a great time doing the reunion shows, but there isn't really any further. We sort of leave it in Mara's hands, and she's, you know, again, I don't want to speak for her, but she's been busy with life, and so if she ever decided, or if any of the other folks decided that that they wanted to do something with it, we could talk about it. I don't know that it's the best representation of us live, but it's cool. It's definitely cool as an archival piece, for sure.
Now the band's done. You're like, okay, I'm gonna head up to New York, right?
I was dating a woman at the time who was trying to decide on grad school, and her one option was the Art Institute of San Francisco, and the other option was Parsons, and she decided on Parsons. And I was like, hey, that's cool. At the time I was managing a recording studio, and it was cool, but it wasn't something that I saw being a like long-term career. It didn't seem, at the moment at least, to be a long-term career choice or career path. So we decided to move to New York, and that's when I got the job at RCA. Major labels. I don't mean to. I'm super thankful for the opportunity to start out there, because the other people, I have very fond memories of RCA. The GM was fantastic, and the people, it was a very small staff. I don't know if, have you worked at other, you've worked at labels. So, everybody there was, as opposed to, oh, sorry, I'm going to back up. It was a very lean, staff, and everybody kind of owned their lane and just totally crushed it. And there were other, I was an admin assistant to the digital marketing department, and there were other admin assistants in other departments with like degrees from Harvard. And it was a very high bar from the start to just be like, everybody, like, it's a skeleton crew, and we're just going to rock all these records. But you've got to pull your weight. So it was kind of like going to grad school for how to be an adult, like, immediately. So it was really cool. And yeah. And I have the Cornerstone peeps, the Cornerstone Network, to thank, for that job. But it was also, I mean, working at labels aside, it was a cool label to be at at that time, because we had Strokes, Kings of Leon, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, Foo Fighters, and believe it or not, all of the American Idol winners, who were also very fun to work with. But yeah, it was a cool start to New York life, for sure.
And what other stuff were you doing when you're? Was it full time job stuff? Were you playing music still?
Yeah, I sort of. So when Denali broke up, I realized, not turn this into therapy, but I'd sort of realized that I had this like debilitating anxiety issues with being on stage. As much as I loved the idea of touring, I was pretty miserable. And it just was, so I sort of wanted to step away from being in bands. I did play with a few folks and started a couple projects with people, thinking like, oh, it'll be cool if it's different. And played in a couple of other friends' bands, just occasionally sort of hopping on stage with people or just into like small project scenarios. But I was still writing things on the side in my room. But never anything that I was like, I think I had like a little MySpace page for it, and I would post things there. But it was, you know, I don't think anybody beyond my friends and maybe a few random Denali fans were listening. But that turned into the composition, into the commercial composition thing. So I sort of took those skills and morphed them into another sort of a whole different world of creativity, which was cool.
So then from that, where was the composing and sort of the, you know, what you sort of led into with music supervision, was that bubbling up at this time or was that later?
Yeah, it was. It was sort of, so friends who were like people that we had toured with, one of them was married to a freelance producer, a commercial producer, and she was talking about, and we were all noticing too, just casually, that indie bands were starting to get licensed more and more for commercials. This is when like the Walkmen got licensed, and a few years before that, Pink Moon had ended up on that famous Volkswagen commercial. And she was talking about the fact that a lot of these clients were looking for music that were by actual bands and not just stock houses. No shade to the composers who write for those houses, but and we were all sort of tight-knit enough to kind of it was started by a few folks. It was a music house called Black Iris, and they were occasionally bringing in friends of theirs that they knew, myself included, to write on specific commercials. It's like, hey, this, you know, we're writing this thing and it needs to have this cool, it needs to be like cool and indie and whatever. I was like, yeah, sure, I can write you something. And that was happening while I was working at RCA and then Atlantic. And eventually it got to the point where there was a real opportunity for me to join them, and the money was better, and the just being with friends again was better. I wasn't like, marketing wasn't really my thing. So it was really hard to sort of pass up. Jonathan from Denali was also working at the same place. And Cornbread, AKA Matthew from Engine Down, was working there as well. So it was just like, I was like, oh, this is great. I can like be in a band, but not have to go anywhere, not ever have to set foot on stage and actually make money from it, and not like stress out my relationships or, you know, like that kind of like all the things that kind of come with being a touring musician. And it just felt like this perfect world. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. So they eventually, I demoed on a couple things and I won a few things. And so they invited me to join the staff full time. And I moved back to Richmond to sort of learn the ropes of the industry and the company. And then I was going to go back to New York at some point because they had an office up there.
The best part about these, and you've heard, is the way that where you are now. And that's why I think this arc you're not on stage, you're still creating music, and you're successful at it in a way that I think can pull from all of your designs or all of your influences that can play for another genre or another sound.
Right.
And it's not in a context of a band.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think it is what a lot of artists want to transition to, the artists who are not already, you know, obviously very successful, but there are, I was surprised at the number of people who are successful, who do also write for commercials on the side, or who also score for trailers on the side. Like, it was really eye-opening to be like, oh my God, you guys knew about this the whole time? Like, why didn't I do this sooner? This would have been amazing. But it's tricky. And, you know, if you're doing a band and doing that, like, you really don't have a home life, or it's very challenging, at least from my experience, to have a competent home life. And once, like, girlfriends started turning into wives, and how, you know, apartments started turning into houses, and kids come along, it's like, you really like that. Like, what is the next step that I can either, like, if we're in a position where we can bring them along with us, then that's great. But if we're not that big, then where's that position where you can still do something music related and pay the bills?
There's so many people that do this. I mean, it's nuts. Like, I hear from bands I haven't spoken to in a while, and a lot of times, like, oh yeah, I write for commercials, or I write this. And like you said, that transition. And I think it's scary for a lot of people, like, starting over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And it also, like, it's an identity eraser to a certain degree, because they're not hiring you because you're in band X or Y or Z. Like, they're hiring you because you're competent, like, because you can write to the creative brief. Right. And I've had lots of friends who have wanted to do it. Not lots of friends. I don't want to say that, because most of the people that I know who do it are wildly successful at it, and actually way more successful at it than I ever was. But, you know, occasionally you would run into an artist who just could not put their own vibe aside, and that's fine. That's, you know, that's because they were very, you know, they were the art that they were creating. And that's, like, you know, it was funny. I was listening to the Hoover podcast, the Hoover interview that you did, like, and there are those artists out there that cannot be anything other than themselves. And right. Hoover is definitely one of them. Fugazi is definitely one of them. In my opinion, Jeff Tweedy's one of those people. Like, you know, you just, going to see them, they're not even playing, like, they're just channeling, and you're just like, oh my God, like, this is it was funny, because I was listening to him talk about, like, you know, if you didn't see us live, you didn't really get to experience the whole thing, and I'm thankful that I did get to see them live. It's like one of my top 10 shows. But yeah, it's to do commercial music, you do need to sort of put that aside, because you can definitely use all of those skills and all of those instincts, but it is a skill in itself.
But what else, the other piece is the hardcore, the DIY, the sort of, like, you talked even mm-hmm. about RCA, which I agree with you, the major labels I worked at, a lot of people think it all, you know, it's all easy. It's not. You still have to rally more people and your team, and there's so much mm-hmm. that, I mean, it is a miracle that a record gets big. Like, so many things have to go right.
Right. Oh, yeah.
But with that, putting all those things aside, you've got the band, they're like, we don't care. Okay, you're competent. But then when you're in that situation, I've talked to other people that these things start to, like, click. They're like, oh wow, I learned that when I was like 16, or mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. happened, or I learned this. And I think I don't fault anyone that hasn't gone to a basement show or put something on or put a zine together or put a tour together with a dialer mm-hmm. in the basement of VCU. But those right. things matter later on when you're sort of put up against that decision and you've had that experience on your own. It wasn't in a book. It wasn't something you read or heard from someone. You did it. And I think right. that helps in that professional field, that I think why there's so many hardcore people, like, there's, like, because I feel like they kind of had those tests early on.
Yeah, it does breed a type of, like, stick-to-itiveness, I guess, that, you know, or just a problem. There's a problem solving muscle that gets built in those early days. Or maybe, like, an open-mindedness, because you know, just never know what's around the next corner. And, I think, especially in my current position, I've learned that you just, like, as a supervisor, like, you just never know what's going to work. And so you just don't say no to anything until you've tried it out. And so I think that, yeah, I mean, and there, yeah, a lot of that is probably born from like being in a band that was trying so hard to be successful and being like, yeah, this, like, you know, there's an opening to play with Iceburn on, like, at a matinee show on Long Island, you know, and you're like, I don't think any of their fans are going to like us at all, but why not? Like, let's just go see. And you meet like one kid who's like, I love your band. And now you have one more like lifelong fan. But yeah, I think it's that scrappiness is sort of good. The music house that I worked for, we were not hyper connected, and we, like, our way into the industry was sort of through the side door. Like, we just sort of tried to do things a little bit differently, and for a time we sort of capitalized on like the fact that it was ad music, but it was being written by dudes in bands who were all like in the same room together, and, you know, had a record label, and, you know, we're putting out cool bands on the record label too, and so, yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of that DIY-ism that kind of sticks with you over the years, for sure.
I love that.
But yeah, it's cool. It is weird though. I like you said, it's really surprising how many people you run into. I think we did a song at one point where the girl from M83 sang on it, and we've done other stuff. I've talked to Jimmy from Album Leaf. He does stuff.
Hell yeah.
I mean, it's really like, I mean, those are one of, you know, millions. I mean, even Johan Johansson used to do ad work. And there are other people who are big now who I don't want to like blow up their scene, who are like top tier, like composers for movies and like just super, super well known, who will also sort of share their library of orphans on the off chance that it works for whatever project it is that you're working on. So I think everybody now, especially that it's so easy to do that on the side with the advent of home studios, like it's really surprising how many people dabble in it. And you're like, oh my God, that person too. It's crazy. It's awesome.
But also the scene itself, you know, emo or even hardcore wasn't as respected, right? Yeah, indie rock was, and even punk to an extent. But mm-hmm. it seemed like it was always sort of seen. And so to know that, like, yeah, Jimmy, Pedro, from Jealous Sound, I know Josh from Shift, like there's countless that they're doing mm-hmm. these things. And it's like all these guys came from these same worlds from different pieces. Some of them may mm-hmm. maybe more metal, more indie. But it's like they can write hooks. They can work with a person right. and get the job done. And I feel like that's right. not talked about. Like, I don't know. It's like it's like what if that review wasn't shit on because it just had a word attached to it and you listened to it deeper? And I think right. maybe there's a better coda for this time period than mm-hmm. people realized. Like all these right, people are right. still, I will meet them or they'll find out about the podcast and they'll just be like, oh, that's so cool. And then look what I'm doing. Like you're doing these fucking amazing things. And I know that happens for everybody, but there's like a point for this genre where it's like or even era that it was just like cast aside. And I think the perseverance and still doing it and making music, and it's sort of, I don't know, came back in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah. I think to a certain degree, a lot of that was probably self-inflicted. I think some of us just didn't. I mean, we wanted so badly not to be associated with anything on right. a major label or like anything mainstream that we would just avoid all those things. But you realize that, like you're talking about, like you still have those chops. You wouldn't be caught dead playing in a band that played those things, but you still know how to do them. And in the back of your mind, because you probably learned, like that's probably how you learned to play the instrument, right. you know, is by playing those songs and like whatever cheesy cover or even, you know, like the Beatles, like people that I used to teach guitar for a minute in college, and the best students I had were always the students who were learning songs, not the ones who were learning from a book, like because there's a familiarity there and they, you know, they know how it goes or they can show off for their friends. they still are, you know, oftentimes those early, like I grew up like very, very, very like beginning guitar days. Like I said, it was like sort of metal and like UK progressive music. But there were also, I was really into Jimi Hendrix and I got into like Stevie Ray Vaughan for a little bit. And it's like, I wouldn't be caught dead playing in a blues band. But if I get hired to play that stuff as a composer, I can play it because I had to play it back then. And no, you know, I never would have mentioned that stuff when I was in and like in the indie scene. Like you just wouldn't, you don't want to poison the well, like in by being like, yeah, I kind of like that stuff. I was like, you know, and there were definitely people who were like, yeah, fuck everybody, I'm super into this or that, but yeah, it was definitely like you just. I think the world of indie and emo sort of kept to itself, and there was pride in that for sure. But I think we probably shot ourselves in the foot a little bit, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. The whole third wave of emo, I don't know really anything about. Like I stopped sort of I don't know what it was like for them.
Do not worry about that. I am bummed that we didn't mention Stevie Ray Vaughan at the beginning. Because I mean, my first South By, I literally, the first thing I did was walk to the statue.
Whoa, crazy.
I adore SRV. I actually, if you looked at my YouTube watch history, it's got all these live videos and stuff. I used to watch their Austin City Limits. He did it a few times.
Oh, man.
So I'm a huge fan of his. But you're right, like, later on in bands, right, that you'd meet someone and they're like, do you guys want to do, like, you know, Boogie or whatever. I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, sure. And they're like, Tom, you just played like a Saves the Day song. Like, how do you, I'm like, I don't know. For like 2 years, I was obsessed. I like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was, I mean, I don't know. There's something to that, like, to, especially like if you're into the more, you know, ability-based side of music, you know, like whether that like skill or theory or just impressive performance, showmanship. I don't want to use the showmanship angle, but like I went to see Joe Satriani when I was a kid. That was one of the first shows I saw. And you know, just because it was like, wow, that guy's doing crazy shit on the guitars. Like I didn't know that I wasn't supposed to be into that. And,
right.
And, but it's good because you do sort of carry it with you in the back of your mind, even though you sort of push all that aside when you're like, no. Like I want to play, like I want to sound like this band or this band or this band. But yeah, it's, I don't know. I mean, that stuff is really impressive. And if it's done tastefully, like that kind of skill is just ridiculous. And Stevie Ray Vaughan was definitely one of those people where you're like, yeah, that guy is a natural talent. Love or hate whatever he's doing.
Right.
Like,
dude, yeah. I think he actually cared. Like sometimes with Satch or Vi or Yngwie, mm-hmm. like it was just fucking noodle to noodle.
Yeah.
Him,
yeah,
I was
sure.
Like, he fucking means every single note.
Yeah. 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 Well, and it's crazy too. I was talking to, so one of my coworkers from RCA is now a tour manager, and he does the Strokes family of bands, and he also does Bruce Hornsby. And the guitarist playing with Bruce Hornsby right now is this guy named Gib Droll, who's from Virginia Beach. He also plays with Brandi Carlile, and he was like as I was saying at the top of the podcast, just to bring this full circle. In order to get gigs in Virginia Beach, he had to play covers. And so he would play Jimi Hendrix and Stevie Ray Vaughan covers. And he was fucking ridiculously good. And I would just sit there watching him. And even him playing, and this doesn't usually happen. Like, you know, everybody talks about, like, if you're going to do a cover, you got to own the song, like, make it yours kind of thing. Like, he really was amazingly adept at taking source material and interpreting it in a way that made it feel like his. And maybe that just speaks to the songwriting, like Stevie Ray Vaughan's songwriting or obviously Jimi Hendrix's songwriting, that it's that good where like almost anybody can play it and you're still moved by it. But yeah, it really does, like, it makes a huge difference when somebody just channels again, like, and he was one of those guys, and you were like, it didn't feel, like you said, it didn't feel like Satriani or Yngwie, like it didn't feel like they were showing off just to show it. There was something transformative about all those notes and in that sequence or in that style that was just like incredible to watch.
I love that.
Yeah, random Gib Droll aside. Hi, Gib, if you're listening.
I love it.
It's funny. He doesn't know me. We don't know each other super well. But I interviewed him for a class project my senior year of high school. So there's a vague memory just drifting about in the back of his head. But yeah, anyway.
As long as you put something out in the world, something happens.
Yeah, it's true.
Anything else you want to mention?
No, I think you covered way more than I ever would have thought to mention. So yeah, apologies for not filling in the gaps a little bit better.
You were fine. You were perfect. You were not bad right on, at all. You right knew on. You had all your stuff. It was fun to, you know, go down that memory lane.
Right on.
And I think if there's any other sort of like parting words or anything that you sort of,
I'm just very, I feel very lucky, and I'm very. I feel very lucky to be able to still do music after all these years. And, I'm very thankful to everyone that I played with for, you know, putting up with me, in the worst of, you know, the not so great times, when those happen. And I don't know, it's just, music is such a powerful thing. And I feel like, you know, everybody's got there's something that moves them, and I really appreciate you doing this podcast and just sort of giving people a chance to reflect back on it, because it's a period that, especially again being older, that I haven't thought about in a long time, and it was such an impressionable period of time. It's great. Thank you so much for the opportunity.